What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to this episode. I am your host, Josh Cohen. This episode, I'm extremely pleased to present to you an interview that I did with the author James Reston Jr. James Reston Jr. is a journalist, documentarian, and author of political and historical fiction and nonfiction. He has written about the Vietnam War, the Jonestown Massacre, the JFK assassination, the impeachment of Richard Nixon, and 9/11. He was also David Frost's Watergate advisor during the Frost-Nixon interviews. And in this episode, he describes how he came to be involved with the Frost-Nixon interviews, what the experience of going through it was like, and his assessment of the aftermath. And now I give you James Reston Jr. Probably your most famous book, from what I gather, must be The Conviction of Richard Nixon. The movie that it's based on, Frost-Nixon, which, of course, is itself based on the Peter Morgan play, is probably one of my all-time favorite movies. And, yeah, and I'm curious, how did you first come to Richard Nixon as a subject?
In 1973, I was teaching in Chapel Hill, and the Watergate scandal began, and it eventuated into what were known as the Irwin Committee hearings, which were the Senate committee hearings that were led by Senator Sam Irwin of North Carolina. And it was in those hearings that it was revealed that there was a taping system in the White House Oval Office. Ultimately, that's what did Nixon in. But as those hearings began in 1973, I took a leave of absence from North Carolina and came to Washington thinking this is going to be the greatest political drama of my life.
Sure.
Watching this thing play out in one way or another. And so I was in Washington, 73, 74. I got matched up with a guy by the name of Frank Mankiewicz, who was a figure here in Washington, and he was writing a book about the demise of Richard Nixon, and he asked me to be his co-author in that whole thing. So 73, 74 to the 74 was the resignation of Nixon. I was here in Washington working with Frank and taking in this whole extraordinary drama of the demise of Richard Nixon. So then I went back home, and as it turns out, David Frost, having secured the rights to this exclusive interview with Nixon for a tremendous amount of money, came through Washington knowing that the Watergate interrogation of Nixon was everything for him, most importantly to David Frost, the money side of things. I mean, he had to be successful in his interrogation of Richard Nixon. And so he came through Washington and asked a number of people if they knew anybody who was a kind of Watergate expert who could help him. And I was suggested. So that's how I got associated with David Frost. They ultimately rented an apartment in Georgetown here that had a bedroom in the back, which is where I slept. And in the front of that sort of suite became the office for the Frost-Nixon enterprise. And so, you know, I was did 8 months of research or something like that before we went to California for the interviews. So it was an amazing experience. It ended up being, I think to this day, the largest audience for a public affairs program in the history of American broadcasting. And it was the Watergate show led to the apology of Richard Nixon and the acceptance of his criminality, which is, you know, was all based on my research. So that was wonderful enough. And then, you know, I went on to my career, kind of forgot about that sort of thing until something like 2006 or seven, I got this call from Englishman Peter Morgan, who said that he thought this might make a good play, and would I help him? And of course, I loved the theater, and I said certainly I would. So I met with him in London and in Washington, and then I realized that when I went back to Chapel Hill after the broadcast in 77, I had sat down and I had written a narrative of my experience and the whole thing. And so I gave him that manuscript, and it is the basis of the Frost Nixon play. So he called me up sometime afterwards and said the play was going to go up in a small theater in London, and would I come over and be with the actors on the first couple of days of rehearsal. And by that time, they had secured Frank Langella as the Nixon actor and Michael Sheen as the Frost character, and a very good Shakespearean actor as the Jim Reston character. It was a big hit straight away, and then it moved to the West End, which is Broadway of London, and then went over to Broadway in New York. And in the course of that trajectory from this 100-seat theater in London to the West End to Broadway, that's when Ron Howard bought the film rights to the thing. And then when that whole thing got together, Howard asked me to come out to talk to the actors before they began filming. And also Sam Rockwell came down, spent a couple of days with me here in Washington. So that's all been a really wonderful experience.
And Sam Rockwell, of course, having just won an Oscar.
Oh, he's so great.
Oh, it was a phenomenal performance.
He's an extraordinary character. It was actually very funny for me at the beginning. I didn't know anything about Sam Rockwell. So when Ron Howard told me that he had cast this actor named Sam Rockwell as the Jim Reston thing, would I come to New York and meet Rockwell, which I did. And before I went up there, I looked into his background, and it turned out that Sam Rockwell had never graduated from high school and had been a real druggie in his early life. And I thought, you know, here's this role of the so-called intellectual of the prostitution thing, you know, who finds the great material that brings Nixon down, and he's going to be played by this dummy who didn't graduate from high school. I quickly came to understand what a fabulous character actor Sam Rockwell is, and I'm a huge fan and just so pleased for him that he's finally been recognized.
Oh, very much so. I am curious can you please describe, what was it like the first time you met Richard Nixon? Where was it? How would you describe him as a person, Mr. Reston?
Well, the taping of those interviews was done in a little town north of San Clemente, which was the Western White House, and where Nixon went in exile after his disgrace.
Yes.
And so they rented a house for the tapings there, and it was a very intimate situation. The set was in the living room of this house. And then there were bedrooms off this very large living room. And that's where each of the camps set up shop, myself and Bob Zelnick and the English producer and money man for the thing. And then in another bedroom was Nixon's crew, which included Diane Sawyer. Diane Sawyer was really my counterpart. She was the one that did the Watergate research for Nixon, as I was doing the Watergate research for Frost. And so when the taping began, and this is sort of a wonderful moment in the movie, actually, as the Nixon motorcade arrives at this house for the first time. And, you know, I'm very awed by all of this. And very anxious, of course, about how this thing is going to play out. But the first day of taping, then there's a break in the proceedings, and the two camps kind of gather with one another, and there's Nixon in the kitchen. And that's the first time that I met him. There's a really terrific photograph taken of that moment. Mm-hmm. I have in my study here, and it's the body language is just hilarious, because there's Nixon sort of leaning against the icebox, and Jim Reston's on the other side of the icebox with his arms folded in a very defensive way. And so the sort of the disgust at the same time awe is very much in the body language. My body language as I'm listening to him talk.
Wow. As the interviews were going on, Mr. Reston, when they were in proceeding, what was your view on how the interviews were going before the Watergate portion? Certainly for the, in terms of the movie, the impressions given that the Frost Camp is not quite out, but certainly down. So what were your thoughts on it as it was going on?
My involvement in that was very emotional. I mean, I have mentioned the Vietnam period of my life. The Nixon presidency came about in 68, the campaign where Nixon said he had a secret plan to end the war in Vietnam. And at that point, there were 19,000 American casualties through the Johnson involvement, Kennedy and Johnson involvement in Vietnam, 19,000. So Nixon sort of convinces the American people that he has a secret plan to end the thing. Well, of course, he didn't end it at all, and it happened through his entire presidency. And the Vietnam War, when it ended in 1974-75, there were 58,000 American deaths. So the Nixon administration itself is responsible for something like 25 or 30,000 deaths after he took office. It was hugely important to me that that be acknowledged and that he be interrogated on that whole side of things. But then there was the whole Watergate thing, which was my dominion. And Nixon, of course, had resigned before he could be tried, either in the Senate or in a court of law. And if Nixon, as daunting and powerful a figure as he was going to just walk right over Frost, the American people would have ended up wondering whether they had done the right thing to drive Nixon from office. And so I went into this whole thing with a kind of, say in all due humility, a kind of historical burden on me as I perceived it, that the Watergate interrogation of Nixon by Frost had to be hugely successful and had to put Nixon's criminality on display. And he had to acknowledge his criminality and he had to apologize to the American people. So that was the goal going into the thing. And I was, you know, deeply invested emotionally in that goal. Well, as the interviews were constructed, very cleverly, actually, by David Frost, the soft material, the domestic policy material and the foreign policy, national security material, was done first. And I had no role in doing the research for any of that. That was Zelnick's purview. And Zelnick was pretty lazy. Hadn't done very much work in preparing Frost for that whole thing. So hours and hours of interviewing Nixon at the beginning was very soft, and Nixon was very presidential. And the nightmare that I had from the very beginning that Nixon would come out of this thing unscathed by Watergate and presidential was going to lead to this disaster. So I sort of was in high anxiety and high dungeon as the thing started to unfold, with Nixon winning hands down over Frost. And as you see in the play and in the movie, you know, the Frost crowd was very upset by how this was playing out and came down hard on Frost, that he was letting Nixon off the hook and so forth.
Yes.
And all of that is absolutely accurate. We were, you know, I think close to vicious in telling Frost he was blowing the whole enterprise. And of course, you know, Frost not only was going to blow it, as as a political matter or as a broadcast matter, but he was also going to jeopardize his whole fortune. If the thing was didn't have anything new in it, then he was going to lose his shirt financially.
Wow.
So there was this break in proceeding between the other material of about a week. And I would ask to say, parenthetically, Frost would bring people in to listen to the domestic policy discussion with Nixon, and it was so bad that people were going to sleep watching it. So David Frost got the message in that week before the Watergate interrogation, and he really buckled down, and he looked very, very deeply into the research that I had given him. And I had also constructed about an 80-page, what I think of as an interrogation document.
Yes.
For the show itself, which folded into it these surprises that I had had discovered that had never been public before. And so the thought was, if we could spring these surprises on Nixon at the very, very beginning of the show, he would begin to wonder, my God, what all do they have here? And it would allow Frost to take charge of the interview rather than Nixon. And that's the way it happened.
Wow.
In the Watergate show. I mean, it's fascinating television to watch him try to react to the to David's bringing these surprises, which I had given to David.
Yeah. No, it is fascinating to watch. I love watching those interviews. And I am curious, as you watch the interviews as they were happening, I'd be terribly curious and keen to know what was your state of mind or thought when you see Richard Nixon officially say the words come out of his mouth that he let the American people down. What was your reaction to that?
You know, that was the highest star that we were going for. You know, it would have been satisfactory enough if it was very clear in that harsh prosecutorial method of David that Nixon had fallen flat on his face, that his criminality was clear to the American people. If beyond that he were to apologize, I mean, it would just be totally, if you'll permit me to say, the frosting on the cake. And so I was just, I mean, we were just absolutely bowled over. Mind you, the way that thing was sort of played out, Frost adopted, at my suggestion, this facts and dates prosecution in which the surprises would be sprinkled into the whole thing. And as you know, as this just got worse and worse and worse for Richard Nixon, ultimately this aide to Nixon, Jack Brennan, stomped onto the set and demanded that the proceeding stop. This was an amazing transgression. I mean, millions and millions of dollars were at stake in this enterprise. And for an aide to Richard Nixon to come onto the set was just an extraordinary thing. And at any rate, the proceedings had to stop with that. And there was a break in the proceedings in which Brennan came into our room and the negotiation went forward as to, okay, if David were to relent in this prosecutorial facts and dates approach to the thing, what would Nixon do? What would we get? Would we get an apology, in effect? And nothing concrete came out of that negotiation. Brennan didn't promise that that's what would happen. So it was left to Frost to decide whether he would continue on the way he had been going on this, which was obviously very successful, or whether he would back off and see if a kind of gentler approach would elicit an apology. I was very critical privately of David Frost being chosen for this historical job at the beginning, but he was the one who got the thing, and so I threw myself into trying to make it as good as it could be. But actually, when it happened, David Charles Frost proved himself to be the very best person in the world to do this whole historic thing, because he was at that point not only a journalist, but he was an actor.
Yes.
Could use wit and English humor and wryness in a way that there was nobody on the American journalistic front that could do that. And so instinctively at that point, he made the decision to cease being the prosecutor and become the father confessor. And the way he handled that thing after the break in the proceeding was quite extraordinary.
Wow.
And it gave us this unique thing in American history of an American, a major American figure apologizing for bad behavior. It was just amazing. And we, when it was all over, we all, you know, in our room, we all threw ourselves into one another's arms. I mean, it was just far more than we anticipated might happen.
Wow, that's incredible. Thank you so much for sharing that. Just to perhaps cap off our Frost-Nixon discussion, I'm curious, has there ever been a question about the Frost-Nixon interviews that you haven't been asked that you wish someone would ask you?
No, I don't think. I think I've pretty well covered the waterfront and all of that. But the important question, and there's been focus on it, but it's something I always like to highlight, that when the Watergate program was actually broadcast, there was no sense that there had been this break in proceedings. And it was the way it was edited, the prosecution of Nixon just folded seamlessly into the apology. And I thought it was important that the American people understand that there was a break in the proceedings and that Nixon had an opportunity to collect himself and to decide what he wanted to do, which gave us the apology. It has led to historians questioning whether the apology was sincere or whether it was just kind of constructed as a scenario between him and Jack Brennan, his major aide. Sort of, they thought, well, okay, well, what do I have to say to satisfy people here? So was the apology sincere or was it insincere? I personally believe it was absolutely sincere. He was broken by Frost. And what came out of his mouth in that second portion of the thing was sincere. But there are historians, including his presidential historian, Robert Dalek, who dispute that and think it was just a cocked-up, made-up deal. It didn't come from the heart at all. So that remains the kind of a question that hovers historically over those interviews. So I got in tremendous trouble with David Frost for revealing that break in proceedings. And the way that happened was that, you know, I went back to my little farm in Chapel Hill, and as it got closer and closer to the interviews, my phone was ringing off the hook with people who wanted to talk to me about, you know, what was coming. Ultimately, right before the program, David Frost was on the cover of Time magazine and Newsweek. And so the anticipation was huge for these things, and that's what led ultimately to the 50 million people who watched the Watergate program. And I thought that it was important that people know about this break in the proceedings. So with all of this pressure from the press for me to talk, I called a press conference in Chapel Hill thinking, well, it could just be the North Carolina press. People flew in from everywhere, Atlanta, for this press conference. And that's where I revealed that there'd been a break in the proceeding. And Frost regarded that as a betrayal, that he was broadcasting this seamless thing from the prosecution into the apology. And here was his aide revealing that, in fact, there were really two portions to the thing, and maybe the apology was insincere. And he was furious. But my little press conference became national news, and Frost wouldn't talk to me for 10 years. So that's the way it rolled out. But you know, I have no regrets whatever about doing that. I thought, you know, given the historic nature of this thing, people needed to know how it happened.
Well, Mr. Reston, this was a real pleasure. I've been wanting to speak with you for many years, so I cannot tell you how much I appreciate you taking the time for me.
Well, it's lovely to talk to you, Josh, and I appreciate all the good research you did. So it's really fun for somebody like myself to talk to somebody like yourself that's really done their homework.
Wow.
So it's a real pleasure.
Well, thank you, sir. I very much appreciate it. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Good. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Mr. Reston.
Take care.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on eyewitness history, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.